You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of IAS 2007, the fourth International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Pathogenesis, Treatment, and Prevention. Sydney, Australia, July 22nd through July 25th, 2007.
I'd like to welcome everyone to the second installment of the Body Pros coverage of the fourth International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Pathogenesis, Treatment, and Prevention. This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of The Body Pro. I'm here with Dr. Daniel Berger, Medical Director of North Star Healthcare in Chicago and a Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I should note that Dr. Berger is one of the authors on the Titan study and has been an investigator on some of the studies he is about to discuss, including the DUET and the SHAPE studies. Welcome, Dr. Berger.
Thank you, Bonnie. I'm very happy to be here.
Dr. Berger, today again was a busy day with many simultaneous important presentations. What stood out for you today?
One of the more anticipated and talked about studies during this meeting was the Titan study. The Titan study was actually the very first randomized controlled trial comparing the most recently approved protease inhibitor, boosted darunavir, to lopinavir-ritonavir. As you all know, boosted lopinavir has already been well established for use in the early or not heavily experienced population and has been considered the gold standard in the industry. Darunavir, on the other hand, has changed our thinking about what we now can do and establishing treatment for even heavily antiretroviral experienced patients. As you may recall, the previous POWER study showed us that darunavir use in a triple-class resistant or very treatment-experienced patient population can allow us to achieve undetectability in substantial numbers of patients when there was at least one additional active antiviral drug in the regimen. This was felt to be unprecedented compared to, say, what we saw in the Resist-Otoro studies. So getting back to Titan, in this study, subjects were randomly assigned to boosted darunavir or lopinavir plus a physician-directed optimized background regimen. The study population was not the typical patients with advanced disease that are usually seen in conventional salvage trials. Instead, treatment experience was defined as having at least 12 weeks of hard experience, and patients who had previous or current use of lopinavir, darunavir, tipranavir, or enfervitide were excluded. Enfervitide was not allowed to be part of the optimized regimen. Approximately 300 patients were randomized to each arm, 18% were black, and 21% female, so the trial contained a very good heterogeneous representation. At 48 weeks, results showed that 60% of patients on lopinavir achieved plasma RNA values below 50 copies, while in the darunavir arm, significantly more, or 71%, achieved below 50 copies. This was highly statistically significant. Actually, a significant difference between both arms was seen at 24 weeks and increased by week 48. Significantly more patients achieved viral load reductions in the darunavir arm than lopinavir, and log reductions in RNA were significantly greater for darunavir versus lopinavir, 1.95 log drop RNA versus 1.72 logs, respectively. Similarly, CD4 count gains were observed in both groups, 81 cells in lopinavir and 88 cells gained in darunavir arms. Various sub-analyses also favored the darunavir arm. More patients who had baseline viral loads greater than 100,000 achieved suppression, 74 versus 63%. Also, HIV drug resistance was studied for among the patients who had viral breakthrough during the study. A greater failure rate was seen in the lopinavir arm compared to the darunavir arm. In addition, loss of susceptibility to protease inhibitors and or NRTIs occurred in more patients on lopinavir than darunavir. And more patients on lopinavir, 24%, lost susceptibility to lopinavir compared to only 11% in the darunavir arm losing susceptibility to darunavir. Also, more patients on lopinavir lost susceptibility to their background NRTIs in their optimized background regimen than patients on darunavir. And overall lower emergence of NRTI resistance was seen upon failure than lopinavir. Interestingly, where patients on the lopinavir arm had baseline lopinavir fold changes less than or equal to 10, more patients, or 70% on darunavir versus 63% on lopinavir, achieved HIV RNA values to below 50 copies. Since this was a sub-analysis, it was not really powered to show differences in these smaller subsets. All right, you've heard all the numbers, so now how does this shake out? Because the Titan study was published so recently in The Lancet, there was much buzz and discussion in the hallways between the conference rooms. The discussion centered mostly around the question of whether Darunville will replace other options in this earlier treatment population and what some of the sub-analysis results really mean. Clearly, Titan demonstrated that there was some important differences between these two agents. Clinicians may find it hard to ignore the surprising results and factor in the fact that the number of lopinavir patients having grade 2 to 4 events of diarrhea was twice that of darunavir patients. Although the newer formulation of lopinavir has improved diarrhea for some patients, there is still a significant number of individuals who still have diarrhea with the new lopinavir tablets. And that's why many clinicians do not dose lopinavir QD. For many clinicians, this study will help with decision-making for patients who have failed their first regimen. When weighing whether to put them on lopinavir versus darunavir, I know I'll be thinking about the significantly more patients that failed lopinavir during the study, and that many of those lost more susceptibility to other PIs and NRTIs while on lopinavir. One of the most exciting new drug classes in development is the area of integrase inhibitors. An important study presented during this session, the same session of Titan, was a small study of naive patients treated with the new integrase inhibitor MK0518, also known as raltegravir, presented by Marty Markowitz. MK0518 is a strand transfer inhibitor that is metabolized by glucuronidation. Since it is not metabolized via the CYP3A4 metabolism that other agents utilize, it does not require ritonavir boosting. It is currently dosed as BID. During the study, patients were initially dosed at 100, 200, 400, and 600 milligrams BID versus an arm with efavirenz. Each arm included treatment with tenofovir and lamivudine, or 3TC, as the background therapy. Almost 200 patients were treated, and although this was a naive population, approximately one-third had a diagnosis of AIDS at baseline. At week 48, the results showed that all treatment arms achieved optimal suppression of below 50 copies of HIV RNA, at close to almost 90%. Interestingly, looking at the graph of viral load decline, patients on the MK0518 achieved optimal suppression faster at within 8 weeks compared to efavirenz. Efavirenz actually required 24 weeks for a mean number of patients to achieve undetectability. An additional presentation during the same session presented by Jay Murray discussed achievement of undetectability at various time points compared to efavirenz. In the various MK0518 treatment groups compared to efavirenz, at all time points, at day 15, day 29, and day 57 treatment with MK0518, the MK0518 showed greater likelihood to achieve optimal suppression and appears to alter the curves of both first and second phase of viral decay. In Markowitz's presentation, however, by week 24, all patient groups achieved optimal suppression, and this was sustained out to 48 weeks. All groups had similar CD4 count gains, approximately 144 to 221 cells per cubic millimeter. The emergence of resistance was only seen in a few patients during the study. 5 patients from the MK0518 treated groups developed virologic failure. 2 of the 5 developed resistance mutations to integrase, as well as the M184V, and 1 had the K65R. The patient in efavirenz arm with failure developed K65R and the NNRTI-associated mutation, the G190E mutation. Regarding side effects, overall, the treatment with MK0518 was well tolerated. There was no dose-response relationships to the various integrase inhibitor arms. Interestingly, the lipid panels showed little effects on lipids for integrase inhibitor groups versus some increases in mean cholesterol and triglycerides for the efavirenz-treated arm. This study was a smaller cohort, but a very large phase 3 study is currently being conducted in naive patients being administered MK0518 or raltegravir. I think that this integrase inhibitor may become a serious consideration for use as first-line therapy for naive patients. This particular regimen has the advantages of being potent treatment while establishing a very high barrier for resistance and would not require ritonavir boosting. It also is an NNRTI and PI-sparing regimen. thus saving these other classes for a second-line regimen, potentially. As the various new agents continue study for differing patient populations, not just their armamentarium and landscape for treatment that will be vastly improved, but that sequencing of different regimens will also be changing, no doubt. Also, an additional interesting small report that was presented by Edwin DeJesus in a poster presentation was shown today. In his small study, he reported on the very first instances of patients that were treated with elvitegravir or the GS9137 integrase inhibitor and then was switched after failure to MK0518. During the study, the patients were switched initially in their integrase inhibitors, and after 7 days, they had their optimized background regimen re-optimized. The results, unfortunately, showed that there was cross-resistance that occurred between elvitegravir and raltegravir. Data from the study of only these two patients was rather small, but I think this is a really important indicator of what we're going to be seeing in the future, and that, unfortunately, it does not look like that individuals can be sequenced from one integrase inhibitor to the other. Another study highlighted a new second-generation NNRTI, the TMC278, also known as rilpivirine. At the last CROI, 48-week data was already presented from the phase 2 study of TMC278, which was combined with tenofovir and tricitabine formulation, one pill, or the AZT3TC combination, and showed comparable efficacy to efavirenz. Also, during this previous presentation, both central nervous system effects and rash, usually not uncommon with efavirenz treatment, was more scarce in the TMC278-treated patients. Also, Anton Pozniak presented a poster here at the conference that details the less CNS side effects associated with TMC278. However, at this conference, metabolic parameters such as the effects on lipids and glucose was focused on. Overall, significantly less elevations in TMC278-treated groups were observed compared with efavirenz, and the area of triglycerides, total and LDL cholesterol. In regards to pharmacokinetics, an important poster was presented by Van Heeswijk. It was shown that there's an important drug interaction with H2 antagonists. It's not uncommon in clinical practice that patients with HIV infection or on multiple medications need to sometimes take H2 antagonists. And as many of you remember, there is a strong drug interaction between atazanavir and H2 antagonists that has made it for the two combination of drugs not be recommended to be used together. In this poster presentation, when TMC278 was administered 2 hours after famotidine, TMC278 Cmax and AUCs were reduced by 85%. However, when TMC was administered either 4 hours or 12 hours after famotidine, TMC278 levels were not affected. Thus, this suggests that when TMC278 is being administered and patients need to also take an H2 antagonist, that they should not be dosing it together and they should consider dosing it at least 4 hours apart. The TMC278, all in all, appears to be a potent NNRTI for which a small dose of 75 milligrams QD is being studied and going forward. Part of the buzz around this drug during the conference is that this agent will have the propensity to becoming combined into single-dose formulations or other QD combinations. One-pill single-dose heart regimens are sexy for patients and easier and more practical. So I hope to see this idea moving forward. CCR5 entry inhibitors is another new class of antiviral agents, and we really expected one of them, maraviroc, to have been available on pharmacy shelves by now. But almost from the beginning, development of this class has had its ups and downs. Initially, aplaviroc, which was also known as 140, was discontinued due to unexpected hepatotoxicities, and concerns about this potentially being a class effect made it so that the future of other CCR5 inhibitors were put into question. Maraviroc was voted unanimously by the FDA's Committee for Approval recently, which historically would be nothing more than a formality for a drug's approval. Everyone, indeed, had expected for Maraviroc to be approved, but on June 20th, the FDA requested further clarification regarding the drug, so we really don't know when Maraviroc will make it to market. Another CCR5 antagonist presented by Cal Cohn, called INCB009471, administered for 14 days in a small phase 1 trial versus placebo in HIV-infected R5 tropic virus patients, was presented. At day 14, it showed a rapid HIV RNA decline, near 1.8 log drop observed at day 16, and the viral load continued to be suppressed on day 20 to 1.7 logs, which was 6 days after this agent's last dose. Also, interestingly, even 2 weeks following the last dose, 0.8 logs were still observed. It had been initially that we were very concerned about the future development of this class of drugs, but it looks like that there are a number of new agents that are still in development and even newer ones that are being proposed. Vicravirok also had its hurdles when increased reports of malignancy were seen in phase 2 study of the ACTG5211. And then another Vicravirok study in a regimen combined with AZT3TC in antiretroviral naive patients failed to show enough of a barrier of resistance. However, the malignancy issue, which was eventually felt to be a red herring regarding the failure issues, dose and antiretroviral combinations have been readjusted. Today, at the conference, Roy Gulick reported on the 48-week safety and efficacy data for Vicravirok. Initially, patients on ritonavir-based regimens with R5 tropic virus were randomized to 3 different doses with about 30 patients in each group, but the 5-milligram dose was discontinued early following a daily safety monitoring board recommendation. Also, unblinding occurred early following the observation of 5 malignancies that were reported. At 48 weeks, both doses, 10 and 15 milligrams, were shown to sustain viral suppression with log HIV RNA decreases of 1.9 and 1.4 in the 10 and 15 milligram doses, respectively. CD4 counts increased to around 100 cells in both groups, actually 96 and 130 cells, respectively, and 4 and 3 subjects in the 2 groups had co-receptor changes from R5 to dual mixed or X4 tropic virus. Vicravirok is proceeding in a phase 3 study with either the 10 or 15 milligram dose being boosted by ritonavir, while Maraviroc is still left hanging for now, but currently available on expanded access for patients that require another agent. Many clinicians are still debating as to how to sequence this class of drug. Using the drug too late in the disease may eliminate the potential option if particular patients develop dual or mixed tropic virus, which has been shown to occur in greater numbers compared with earlier stage patients. In fact, a poster presented by Matthew Goetz confirmed earlier reports of dual or mixed R5-X4 tropic virus to be associated with faster disease progression. Thus, the big question is whether these agents will become used in earlier advanced patients, different from the way Maraviroc was used during the recently presented phase 3 trials.
Wasn't there also an interesting SMART study sub-analysis today?
Yes, the SMART study has been very much talked about over the last year. Most of you would recall, was a big randomized prospective trial of more than 5,000 patients, which began in 2002, conducted by the Committee Programs for Clinical Research on AIDS, or the CPCRA, comparing patients with CD4 counts greater than 350 cells to be on either continuous heart versus episodic treatment, meaning the study subjects had their treatment discontinued when CD4 counts rose to 350 or greater and was reinstituted when CD4 counts fell below 250. The study was conducted out of the motivation to examine whether taking interruptions of treatment can reduce the long-term toxicities that we know have been associated with heart. But although this patient population was fairly healthy at baseline, with median CD4 counts approaching 600 cells, and over 70% of the patients with less than 400 copies, the study was halted prematurely by the Data Safety Monitoring Board. The study was stopped due to the unexpected observation that patients on episodic treatment, or the drug conservation strategy arm, was associated with an increased risk of death and greater prevalence of opportunistic infections and cardiovascular, hepatic, and renal problems than the virologic suppression strategy arm, or the continuous treatment arm. We still have a lot of data to tease out from this, and in IAS, SMART study sub-studies were presented, one studying the opportunistic complications and mortality issues resulting in patients with Hep C and Hep B co-infection. Another presentation discussing higher rates of required reinitiation of treatment among Hep B virus co-infected patients were also presented. But getting back, today at the conference, Tidaldi looked at the co-infected patients with Hep C and or Hep B, or both, infections, in particular HIV-infected individuals in the SMART study, and their impact on the outcome of disease progression or mortality seen. Of the co-infected patients, the median CD4 counts at baseline were in the upper 500 cell counts, and more than 60% of these patients had viral loads below 400 copies at baseline. During the study, patients co-infected with either Hep B or Hep C numbered 17%. Almost half of all opportunistic disease-related deaths occurred in this population. In other words, the co-infected patients had higher risk of non-opportunistic disease-related deaths than in the non-hepatitis co-infected patients. Additionally, deaths related to both opportunistic disease and non-opportunistic disease were higher in the drug conservation or episodic treatment group. Thus, treatment interruptions with the consequence of HIV viremia and immune suppression is much more dangerous to patients, and particularly to our co-infected population. We discussed yesterday how the co-infected population appears to be growing, thus clinicians should continue to be keeping up on changes in the dynamic of our HIV patient population and the new and surprising results that continue to be emerging from many of these trials.
Well, thank you, Dr. Berger, for another comprehensive review, and thank you all for listening.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on IAS 2007 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/IAS2007.